Izzy. Welcome to Lowercase Sober Part 2. If you're new to the podcast, I define lowercase sober personally as meaning I'm sober but not capital S sober. I don't drink, but I'm not in recovery or rehab in the traditional sense, and I'm not an addict. In part 1 of Lowercase Sober, I talked about my relationship to alcohol, especially being in my 20s. In part 2, I'm interviewing other people about their relationship to alcohol. Each guest in part 2 was asked some of the questions I asked myself when I was developing part 1, and I'm really excited to share their thoughts with you. This episode, our discussion is with someone who is questioning their relationship to alcohol. We also discuss mental health and sexual assault, so if those are topics you are sensitive to, please use discretion when listening to this episode. Without further ado, our guest today is...
Hi, my name is Alex Miyashiro. My pronouns are she, her. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I'm an actor slash performance artist.
I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you so much.
What identifier do you use for your relationship to alcohol?
I would say the best identifier I've found to describe my relationship to alcohol would be featherweight class. I'm extremely lightweight. Kind of nice, honestly, because my body has a built-in stopping point. Like, I can't go past a certain point without being physically ill no matter what. So it won't be enjoyable, but I physically won't be able to drink past 2 mixed drinks. It sucks in like social situations, but that's what it is.
Similarly, my body is like, no. And when I drink, like when I used to drink, I would have like 1 drink and be like tipsy drunk. And there was like no in between.
It's weird. I think because I'm so used to, and this is like a separate thing, but like I'm so used to smoking weed that how you drink alcohol is very different from how you smoke weed, like how it affects you and stuff. And so I have that in my mindset of like, oh, I don't feel like very drunk right now, so I'm going to have another drink, when in reality, like I haven't eaten all day. I've had maybe like 1 glass of water. So that second drink is actually what's going to make me throw up. Whereas if I just like wait long enough, you know, even though my brain is telling me like, oh, I'm done with this drink physically in my hand, let me just go get another one now. That's like not how I should at least drink alcohol, because that's just like usually my downfall. That's why at this point in my life, I usually just stick with cider or a really nice glass of Prosecco or something, because if I go for like a mixed drink, more than 2 in 1 evening is usually like my downfall.
I keep wanting to say same, but I don't drink anymore. But sort of same, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, because I used to try and keep pace with people around me. And that was really like, I think my most least healthy drinking habit was like trying to keep up with the people around me.
100%.
My body just literally was like, not in my house.
I feel like especially in college when I didn't like, I was already like mentally ill, but also now, separate note, but now realizing how much alcohol is like a depressant, maybe it just hits me more now or whatever, but like at the time, not understanding that and feeling weird and then trying to keep up with everyone, so I'm like, okay, well maybe if I just keep drinking it will like fix the situation, when in reality it doesn't. And then usually I would try to like go like smoke a cigarette, and then you add tobacco into the mix and that's when you throw up.
What was the last drink you had? Can you tell me more about the situation in which you had that last drink?
The last drink that I had was not last night, maybe 2 nights ago. Honestly, during this quarantine, I just haven't been drinking as much, because I don't really drink that much at home. Usually I do. If I do drink, it is at this point a specialty cocktail. That's why I'm, as much as obviously everything is horrible right now, I do really miss being able to go to a bar and just like sit by myself. That's something that literally only maybe 2 months before everything happened, I actually learned that I really enjoyed doing, not even to get drunk or anything, just to like go to a place that I know is going to have a cocktail that tastes really nice, sit there like by myself with a book, or get a plate of fries and like listen to a podcast. That is something that I really enjoyed. And then now I have to stay here. So actually, funny, since listening to this, have been trying to drink less vodka at home. Not even because like societal pressures or like peer pressure or whatever, or like my roommates or anything like that. It's mostly just I've noticed that if I have a mixed drink here, I don't know what it is, but I'm usually just end up feeling really sick anyway. Or just, again, maybe it's just having to do with how I'm eating during this quarantine or whatever. I've just been drinking maybe like a cider every couple days, or like we got a bottle of Prosecco to try to last us. During the quarantine, I've been trying to actually drink less, so...
If you do or don't actively drink, is there any reason why?
The more time goes on, I choose to actively not drink hard alcohol because of what it does to me physically. I think the older I get, the less my body can tolerate it, whether or not that's like because I am part Asian and I know that that's like actually part of it, that that's a real thing. Same thing with my dad. My dad, he doesn't drink. He has like maybe a few beers over the course of a year because he physically gets really sick if he tries to get drunk. So it's the same kind of thing. I'm actually not sure with my sister if it affects her the same way, but at least for myself, it's just not fun. It gets to a point where it's not fun. And I would rather have like one drink that tastes really nice over like drinking to get drunk. I haven't drank to get drunk in a very long time. It's been a long time since I've done that. And actually been drunk too. And that's the other thing is that more often than not, even if I do try to like drink to get drunk, I don't even get drunk. I just get sick before I can even like actually have fun and be drunk and like, ooh, like party. Like I just end up going right to the bathroom and it's not fun for anyone. My roommates have to like chase me down the street as I'm like vomiting. Like it's not good. It's just not a good time. Like so at this point, like why? I might as well just like smoke a bowl. Like
I feel that so hard because there was like a point where it was just like, is this even worth it anymore?
Exactly. No, exactly.
Like
yeah.
I feel like mm-hmm. I could like have one beer and like be fine. If there wasn't all this other like societal cultural crap surrounding alcohol that like affects me so much, if I was able to just have one drink and like that would be it, I would be like so solid.
It sucks because I also, even to this day, I'm still trying to figure out the best way for me to drink because sometimes I will go out and have a drink and not feel drunk at all. Sometimes I'll go out and have one and feel really queasy and sick and not good. Sometimes I'll feel kind of tipsy, but like it all affects me differently. I don't know if that's just something I'm doing. I always try to stick to like either vodka or gin. So it's not even like I'm drinking like tequila or weird dark alcohol. I just stick to vodka because I'm a simple bitch. That's all that I need in my life. I don't know. It's harder to gauge and it's expensive. It's so expensive, especially here in New York. I would so much rather save up my money. That's why I would rather like buy a six pack to have here in my house rather than like spend that same amount on one drink I'm going to have in a bar that maybe it'll make me drunk. Maybe it'll make me really sick for the rest of the night.
When I was drinking, so much of my like drinking routine, I guess, was like trying to solve drinking. Like how mm-hmm. do I like drink and feel nothing, have no consequences, or have the least amount the next day?
Finding the equation.
What's the magic formula so that I don't throw up viciously the next day? Yeah, because I remember I would drink vodka and gin, white wine, Prosecco, and IPAs.
Oof.
Because I thought that they were safe.
It has protein, right? IPA is a beer has protein or something. Basically bread.
And white wine is basically a fruit. So like balanced meal.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
What's your best memory associated with drinking?
I don't really have too many really great memories associated with drinking, but I would have to say my best memory associated with drinking that sticks out is my uncle's wedding, which was the first time, and I think honestly the only time I've ever been really beer drunk, because I don't even really drink beer. I just stick to hard cider. But I was in France because my mom's whole side of the family is over there, and it was this really delicious beer, which I think now even I like have tried to like look it up, and it is actually from like one of the oldest breweries in Germany or something like that. So it actually tastes really good. And that's why I was, as a child, I was 14 at this time, but it's France. So I had my first sip of wine at like 11 or 12. And so everyone was drinking. It was a really like small venue. It was basically just our family and like my uncle and his wife's close friends. So it was a small group of people in like a rec center kind of room almost. And we were all just like dancing, drinking, having a good time. My parents don't drink. So they weren't like partaking in that, I guess. It was a really fun atmosphere. And I think looking back then, I started to understand, oh, you were actually drunk, like in the moment, because I was a child. I didn't know that that's what it was. But looking back, I was like, oh yeah, you were drunk. And I think also because my mom doesn't drink, she probably didn't realize that I was actually drunk as a 14-year-old, but I don't know, maybe.
Complete tangent. It's so weird when you look back and you start to recognize like the behavior of people who were drunk.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like from when you were a child mm-hmm. and you're like, oh my God, they were drunk.
Or especially growing up in New York, and I have a distinct memory of walking down the street with my mom, and we were walking by some building with like people leaning out the window, and I'm like, why does it smell like a skunk? And my mom just looked at me and she's like, I don't know. And like thinking back on it now, they're fucking smoking a joint leaning out the window. Like
when I started working as an RA at my undergrad. They literally just like lit marijuana on fire in front of us. And we're like, this is what weed smells like, in case you didn't know. And we were like, okay. But at the time, there were some RAs who like didn't know what weed smelled like because they were just innocent people.
Fresh out of high school, yeah.
They literally were like, oh my God, that's what that smell is? And we were all like, yes, welcome. Now you're going to smell it everywhere.
There you go. Yep, welcome to college.
Time to switch gears a little bit. What's your worst memory associated with drinking?
Most of my memories associated with drinking are actually in the neutral to heavily negative range. I did most of my drinking, or at least all of my irresponsible drinking, during a deeply traumatic time in my life, so I've repressed a lot of it. My first few weeks of college, I was at a party for our major, our like whole major, and a classmate of mine who is a queer man, not once, but twice within the same evening, pushed me against the wall as I passed by him, shoved his tongue in my mouth, then half-heartedly apologized as I pushed him off me. Fun fact, this man within the past week has tried to Instagram message me saying that he has been thinking about our friendship and how much he wants to reach out to me. I have not responded. At a different party, one of my close friends at the time, who is also queer, kept shouting at me to take off my clothes and tried to pull my shirt straps down and touch my boobs when I didn't take off my clothes. This person I really do care about, and I also, again, have had a lot of like weird moments with them when they were drunk. We're not in touch anymore because they were all doing a lot at the time involving their sexuality and gender. So I honestly don't blame them. I think it was mostly just them being very, very drunk and like processing a lot of things. So I, looking back on it, do not feel as negatively towards this person as I do towards the other person. My senior year of college, I hooked up with a guy from Tinder who ended up being a relapsing alcoholic. One day I was outside a rehearsal room scrolling Facebook and saw that he posted a picture of himself in a field behind his father's house with a gun to his head. He checked himself into a hospital and I ended up going to visit him. And while I don't regret going, I now understand what it means to go visit someone. And that's just a lot to like process, especially for someone that I did not know that closely, but like still really cared about. We fell out of touch after that, but about a month later, we ended up meeting up for lunch and all he ordered was beer. I tried to say something, but he brushed it off and didn't talk about it. And after that, I never heard from him again. He deleted all his social media. I can't, even now, I've tried to look him up. I can't find anything about him. About once a year, I still find myself checking the local obituaries to see if he's listed, but I haven't found anything yet. There's a lot more, like a lot more, but those are just some good examples. Again, I was doing all of this drinking in a really dark time in my life. So
when I think about the times when I was drinking in college, it feels like a story someone told me.
Yeah.
Because it was from a part of my life that was so wildly different and populated with so many like darker people.
Oh God, yeah.
People who just did not know boundaries and did not know healthy relationships and did not know the definition of manipulation or consent or anything like that.
Yeah.
And just like
red flags. Yeah.
I had a similar experience with a friend of mine who I don't talk to anymore.
It's honestly interesting also thinking about my experiences with this with queer people and someone like, I mean, name excluded, person was at the time, and this is a direct from his mouth, he was 100% gay, only into men at that time when he was doing these things to me. And so I was very confused. And so at the time I like brushed it off. I was like, oh, maybe it's just like joke or whatever. But then now, especially like thinking back on it, that number one, that's not okay either way, but also like that doesn't like matter, but also like, because he had like gone on to date women now. So he clearly like, he was telling me that to try to make me more comfortable, you know, that's what upsets me the most, is that he, I think, was just using that as like more manipulation kind of thing to try to like lower my defenses, which is like so fucked up. So fucked up.
I had a lot of people like do similar things where they were like, I'm XYZ because I want you to feel more comfortable around me. Or like, I'm a member of the queer community, so it's fine that I'm like groping you at a party, or it's fine that I'm like doing whatever. It's weird because like we're both part of the queer community too.
Exactly. It's like, as someone who is like pan, bi, whatever you want, it's not me trying to be like, be any sort of comment on their like sexuality.
Yeah.
You're trying to fuck me over so you can touch my titties. And I don't want that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm saying no. Like, just because you tell me you're gay doesn't mean that like you can then fucking put your hand on my ass. Like, no.
It's weird because we want so much to support the community and to not feel like we're, especially when we're like young people in it.
Yeah. And if you're drunk and like intoxicated and you're not sure what's going on.
And we're like trying to like play by the rules of a community that we're new to. I came out my freshman year of college. I didn't have out queer friends in high school. All my friends ended up being queer. They all came out in college. I remember wanting so badly. My campus was like really liberal. So it was like a lot of like queer culture cultivation. Like it was like you were a part of it or you weren't. Like you know what you're doing or you don't. You understand or nobody's like people will teach you, but like you have to find them first. I remember just like letting things happen just because I was like, oh, this is the way that it is. I'm like, no, it's not. It really isn't.
I mean, hey, here's a positive queer experience that I love to this day. And it's one of my favorite things that I remember is from a house party in college. I was very drunk. One of the few times I was like actually drunk, I was in some sort of like ridiculously scantily clad outfit, probably like pasties at most. And so I like walked outside to the like backyard seating area and I walk over to my group of friends that was standing there, in addition to like someone who I only kind of knew from the school of drama, but like didn't actually ever have like a direct conversation with. But I was like, I'm drunk. Who wants to touch my boobs? I turned to this person. I was like, do you want to touch my boobs? And they were like, yeah. And so they just like put their hand right on my chest. And I was like, yay. And thinking back on it, it's honestly one of my favorite memories from like a college party, because it was genuinely like happy, filled with just like connecting with people. It's so funny, like looking back on it now, like that I love. That is a great moment that I had, you know, like I love that. And it was honestly not even like a necessarily sexual thing. It was just like, I'm feeling fun. Let's have fun. Like,
what is your scariest drinking story?
My scariest drinking story is one of my spookiest stories that I have also, but it's mostly just really scary. I took a gap year between my second and third year of college, and I made the mistake of trying to pregame on campus before going to a house party, which in my drinking time means I was shit-faced within 10 minutes of arriving at the house. I'm very fortunate in that I have a strong gut sense. So when my body told me that I had 20 minutes before I was going to fully black out, I decided to leave the party. But I was so drunk, I didn't tell any of my friends I was leaving, didn't call myself a car, and just decided to stumble home. My friend Pia has told me whenever I tell this story, always says to me, and I'm still mad at you for not telling me that you were leaving this party because I thought that you died, because I fully could have died. But I got a few blocks in, but the spins had set in. So even though it was the middle of winter with snow everywhere on the ground, I sat on the ground to catch my breath. All of a sudden, this guy appears in front of me. Looking back on it now, I think he was trying to help, but in and out of consciousness state, my New Yorker gut kicked in and I flat out ignored him and got up and kept on walking. A block later, the spins were getting worse, so I sat down again on a stoop in front of a house, and the next thing I can remember is the same man standing in front of me again, offering me his hand and telling me to stand up, that I have to stand up, that I have to keep walking. At some point in this, I called my boyfriend at the time. We were doing long distance, so he was out of state. I don't remember dialing him, but I remember talking to him as this man is trying to help me, because when I was younger, my mom taught me that if I was walking down a street or if I was being followed by someone, that I should call someone or pretend to be on the phone with someone to have that contact or to try to psych out this person. So that's what I did in my blackout state. I remember talking to him, trying to be on the phone with him, and then I get up and I continue walking down the block trying to ignore this man. And I remember walking down the street, turning the corner up my block, like, but you still have a whole block to go. And then the next thing I remember is waking up in my bed the next morning. I was fully clothed. I had my bag, my wallet, my phone, everything. No money stolen. I had all my clothes in the right order and everything. I seemed to be totally unharmed, but I genuinely to this day do not remember getting home. I 100% could have died, not only because it was freezing outside, but also because I am a small person. Like, you can physically pick me up and put me somewhere. So even if I'm passed out, it's not that hard to just put me in a car, you know? The other part of this is that in my spooky, weird witch feeling, there's a part of me that thinks it was my, what my mom says is my guardian angel trying to help me, because I have to think of it that way, because if I don't, then I will think of it as a stranger just like coming upon me in the street, which is kind of horrifying. Maybe I'm just like a paranoid true crime fan, but that's just horrifying. You know, that's not a situation you want to put yourself in. And I did that. I fully put myself in that situation. I'm very, very lucky that I woke up in my house alive and not harmed in any way. You know, I swear, like at least 80% of the time that I do actually end up getting drunk, it ends up being weird, horrible shit like this, or like weird, horrible shit with like interacting with weird people or something. Like, I don't know why I still try to like drink to get drunk. I don't know. I have no idea. It's not good. It's not good. I have one other encounter with this guardian angel figure thing. So that's what also makes me think really? That it, yeah, but that's for like a separate time. Like, that's why it's like, maybe it's that, but it was probably some man trying to help me.
But that's still somebody looking out for you.
Which I am so grateful for that person. I'm so grateful for that human being. They did everything they could. It's not even like they tried to physically manhandle me or anything, you know, like they were trying their best to be helpful. I send prayers to that person every day. Like, that person is a great person.
What is your funniest drinking story?
So my funniest drinking story is technically the same kind of story as the last one that I just told, but a much better ending. And I'm able to laugh looking back on it. Whereas like at the time, it was not, for me at least, it was not funny. For Pia, it was probably funny for a little bit, but also not fun at all. Must have been last year. We went to this art gallery opening thing for a friend of Pia's that was in Manhattan. And there's photo proof of this on Instagram. It's the photo series where Maggie is laying in a bush and we're both in the car lying on each other, because I genuinely don't know how it happened, but I think I just probably had like too many glasses of wine too close together. But I got so very drunk so quickly. I don't know how it happened, but it was like gallery glasses of wine, so like tiny little Dixie cups, like not giant things of wine. So I don't know how I got this drunk, but both Maggie and I ended up getting very intoxicated. So that meant Pia had to like take care of both of us, and so I was not only like stumbling around and basically like not even conscious, but we get the best part of this story is we get back to the apartment. Pia like puts me in my room and like goes to take care of Maggie. And the next thing that happens is I'm fully naked, basically running out of my room bathroom, and all Pia sees is just like a glimpse of my vagina just as I run to the bathroom. Pia's like, all I saw was just a glimpse of the Mons, and that's all I got. And then went into the bathroom, it was a blur. Like, and Pia just like dragging my physical body out of the bathroom because I had like passed out over the toilet, like dragging me back to my room, putting me in bed. Again, this is only funny because Pia recounts this story in the best way to me, but like just picturing it is fucking hilarious to me. It's so funny, but it's only funny because I was safe with people who I actually love and who love me, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, thank God for Pia, truly.
Thank God for Pia. Have you ever done anything that changed your life while drinking?
When I try to think about something that I've done that was life-changing while drinking, because it's so hard for me to get to that level of drunk where I'm able to like make bad decisions, that I don't have a lot of stories like that, which then makes me want to drink more so that I can get those stories. But then I just get sick and it doesn't happen. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's maybe kind of part of it for me growing up, obviously like watching TV and being like, oh wow, so that's what it must be like. I see that and I'm like, oh, that's a real person. So I can like actually maybe be like that. So then I try to drink to get to that like fun social situation. But for myself, it's so hard for me to get that formula right that it doesn't happen. So like, I don't have those memories, even though I really, really want them. The FOMO is so real.
Oh my God. If I could print that on a t-shirt and wear it, I feel like I romanticized that so much. The like saying I love you to someone drunk, or like getting drunk when something bad happens. were like making a big life decision, and like that's not real.
Like, I'm happy for those people and I'm so happy that like they can experience that, but I'm just here like stoned out of my mind like, fuck dude, what am I doing wrong? Like, just yelling at my stomach like, get your shit together, man. Literally get it together, put it in a bag. Like,
do you regret anything you've done drunk?
I think something that I forget when I try to drink is that it makes you more bold in terms of being free and fun and whatever. But it's also a depressant. So if I'm drinking here at home and if I'm like alone in my room and drinking, that is worse because of those feelings. But even if I'm like out in public and I start to have those, because I'm already like mentally ill in like a fun way and in like a real way. If I start to go down that path, it can very easily ruin my evening. And before I understood that, I let that affect a lot of my night, where I would then blame other people, not realizing that alcohol is a depressant. And so like I would have a mood shift and either lash out or blame it on whatever, not realizing that like that's also part of alcohol. That's part of drinking. That's part of like being an adult trying to ingest alcohol, you know, but forgetting that.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if any of that made sense, but.
No, it is an amazing answer to that question. And I think something that other people will relate to.
Cool. I hope. Yeah.
All right, next question. If you drink or used to drink or have a growing and changing relationship with drinking, what did or do you do to stay safe while you're?
Well, I think that story of like my scariest night was definitely a solidifier in my brain. One of your best defenses is yourself. So I have to make sure that even if I'm going to meet up with from like Tinder or whatever for a drink, like telling my friends where I'm going, letting them know what time I'm going to be there until, like keeping track of me. I've only given one person my phone location and it's Pia. And so that I'm always kept track of no matter where. Like, be able to tell me, I'm just watching you, where you're going, like, making sure you're okay. Like, that makes me feel very safe and very good, like, having that. I've honestly also, now in quarantine, it doesn't really matter as much, but if I were to throw myself back out into the dating pool, coming up with some sort of, like, code word system for either, like, my sister or my friends, I feel like is the next step I would take if I were going to try to seriously date more surrounding alcohol, just as, like, a safety measure of, if you need to get the fuck out. Like, so many times Pia will tell me like, oh yeah, if you need to like get the fuck out, just tell them I'm having a breakdown. Like, like I'll call you and like demand that you come home. It's fine. Like, tell them I'm having like, I have to go to the emergency room. It's fine. Having that like in place, you know. Oh, also when I went to college, it's funny because you can't buy or have pepper spray shipped here to New York. But when I went to college in Pennsylvania, my mom sent me some there, which it's legal to have. So I now have pepper spray on me. Every time that I go out, especially with strangers, I have my pepper spray on me.
If you still drink, have you thought about stopping?
I've definitely thought about stopping, especially honestly since this too. I go back and forth because it's not something that I need. It's not something that I like, even am super interested in from like a topic standpoint. Like, it's not like I'm very into mixology or making crazy cocktails or learning about the history or whatever. Like, that's a very fun hobby to have, you know, like that's not even that. If I do drink now, it is for the flavor of the drink or because like I know this one specific bar is like really well known for this one cocktail, so I'm gonna go and I'm gonna have that. Or weirdly, sometimes I'll get home from work and even though I don't drink that often, all that I want is a hard cider, so I treat myself. But it's not something that I really need, so I've definitely thought about just calling it quits altogether. But especially as someone who has other vices and tries to get a hold of my addictions, I feel like a cider every once in a while is not as bad as some other things that I've done to myself. So again, I'm not like drinking to get really drunk or anything anymore. So it's just mostly for fun or with a meal. If I did quit, the main thing would be like trying to date, or the concept of like my theater friends, like going before a show, you go and get a drink while you're waiting, like in the house, you have a drink afterwards to celebrate. You go and you go to a bar. Like, in that situation, I think that's what would pressure me the most, because that's like what was the biggest pressure before. Just, I have a lot of social anxiety in general. So I'm trying to be better about that. And it is also learning that, of like, that is part of learning how to cope with, how to deal with my own anxiety, finding healthier ways that in social situations that don't involve intoxicants, like even smoking weed, like that is a big thing. And again, this is like a maybe a different podcast topic, but something that's really big for me and that I had to acknowledge and then like try to grow past was the social aspect of it. Like if I had friends over, stoners, I got to the point where it was like that was the only thing that was tethering our friendship or tethering like the people together. And so like they would come over, we would smoke a bowl, and it's, oh, you're just sitting there in silence or in like just doing small talk, when in reality if you have those people over just to have fun and just to like hang out or watch a movie or whatever, it is much more fulfilling time, as opposed to like that is what is keeping you together, you know. So I think that is my main thing that I'm dealing with, whereas alcohol, because it makes me so sick, it's harder for me to like substitute that, but I still have that like addict part of my brain, whereas if that's all that I have, then yeah, I'll drink, yeah, I'll like try to be not sober that way, you know, even if I do end up regretting it later, if the social pressure is high enough, I will succumb to it, you know.
Literally the only time that I ever think about drinking now is like dating and theater, that's it. And all of my friends who I was only friends with because we drank together have slowly, like, over the past, oh my God, how many months ago? Since, like, August when I stopped drinking. They've just all, like, faded away. Because there's nothing for us to do anymore.
No, especially in New York when you have the pressure of, like, there's everywhere. You can just, like, go out, walk down the street and go to a bar. It's not like even in Pittsburgh or smaller towns that I've been to where it's, like, there's only the one bar. Here it's, you have all the options, all the choices. Like if you have a certain intolerance, you can go to a wine bar, there's kombucha bars, like there's all kinds of stuff, there's so many options that it's so much easier to give into that.
Like you said, it's so easy, mm-hmm. that it's such an easy option to like for you to hang out with your friends. But the reality is like now that I've been to all the bars sober and I've been to all these clubs sober, the only places that are fun are places where you can dance. No offense, but your theme bars are all like really, really shitty and are really bad. Like hire better graphic designers, like
truly
hire a set designer to come in and like redo your shit because it's all terrible.
Hire one lighting person, please.
Yeah, hire one lighting person so I can see people. It can be fun lighting, yeah. But like I'm so over like the hanging out in like a literal bat cave where you can't hear anything, mm-hmm. and like all of your friends like disappear every 10 minutes and you're like, great, this is so fun.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I just think back to especially my junior and senior year when I started to quote unquote date someone who was not from my college, but like was from like the area. So he had a better understanding. He had better knowledge of bars and the restaurant scenes and whatever. So we started to actually go to more places outside of just like the few blocks around campus. And just thinking back now, if I wasn't drunk or that high, there's no way I would have gone to the establishments like sober to have a nice time. Like they're disgusting, they're not fun, the people are horrible, like why did I ever go to those places in the first place? And like it's the kind of place, I was just telling my friends this the other day, but it's the kind of place where the entire floor is always wet. It's just not, it's not good, it's not a good time. Oh man.
Okay, wait, back to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wait, never mind. That's it. We ran out of questions.
Yay, go team. Go team.
We did it.
That was so fun. And I almost only cried once. I'm so shocked.
Thank you again to Alex for a great conversation. I have a bit of an announcement. If you like the podcast and want to support the project as it moves forward, I have a Patreon now. It's patreon.com/lowercasesober. The perks of becoming a Patreon supporter are great and include exclusive episodes just for Patreon members. Again, you can find my Patreon at patreon.com/lowercasesober. I hope you'll consider checking it out and joining at any of the tier levels. They all have great perks. Every week, we're going to talk a little about racism in recovery and healthcare. And to kick off these discussions, we're going to talk about racism in hospitals as a patient and also pain. First, I'll get my personal experience out of the way here. I'm a white cis queer woman who spent a lot of time in hospitals with family members. Often it's been women in my family trying to spearhead healthcare for other relatives, and I've seen the uphill, inequitable, and discriminatory battles they've faced. I've seen the healthcare system in this country kill people, break their spirit, and cause them to turn away from faith in the broadest sense of the word, just based off of cost and frustration. A little known quirk about being in a hospital is you need to have a patient advocate. It should be a third party, but you need to have someone who will ask questions, get information, write down prescriptions, keep a record of treatments, and maintain lines of communication with doctors, surgeons, nurses, etc. Patient advocacy is only learned from doing it, and it's best performed by people who are close to the healthcare world, meaning current, former nurses, EMTs, first responders, doctors, etc., or people with a high level of education who just, like, know things. That's a terrible way to put it, but basically, if you're, like, really into medical stuff and it's not your career, if a loved one is in the hospital, you might be a great patient advocate. The reason I say this, I've seen a nurse come in to give a double dose of a drug and almost overdose a patient because the previous nurse didn't mark on the chart that the dose had already been given, and the patient would have died. But they had a family member sitting at their bedside to question what was happening. Hospitals are well-run bundles of chaos at times, especially emergency departments. Here's where privilege comes in. I've gotten away with being the patient advocate for literally anyone I've gone to the hospital with. Friends, strangers, people who looked nothing like me, family. I've got to go with them to their rooms and advocate for them without a second thought because, what? I'm white. Yeah. I say that from experience, watching Black family members be questioned by security and staff in emergency rooms, while I've waited with my own people, watching blatant racism and profiling occur, preventing vulnerable, injured, and sick people from having advocates in their rooms. Some hospitals are better than others, obviously, but I've seen these exchanges more than once, and it shouldn't happen at all. The best thing I've learned on the internet, I learned from Black Twitter, specifically Black women on Twitter, and I think it speaks volumes to the incredibly high barriers Black people in America face while trying to access healthcare. I had a hard time finding the original Twitter account from which this tweet came, so if you have it handy, let me know. I'll repost it and include credit in the next episode. But basically, the tip is whenever a doctor refuses a treatment or diagnostic option for seemingly no reason, you ask them to write it down on your chart or in your records that they refuse to perform or give the procedure. Often, they'll end up scheduling the diagnostic, giving you the option for treatment, etc. The reason this works is it leaves a paper trail. It gives the responsibility for care back to the healthcare professional you're working with. Pain is one of the most disbelieved symptoms in Black patients, especially Black women, which leads to such disturbing statistics as Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women, according to the CDC in 2019. U.S. mother-infant mortality rates are scary high for a developed country due to poor healthcare, and then add on top of that, that recent studies have shown that some medical students and doctors that are currently practicing right now still believe racist, outdated beliefs like Black people feel less pain, they have less sensitive nerve endings, thicker skin, blood that coagulates more quickly. Racist, outdated, and horrible myths. Dr. Janice A. Sabin pointed out in a piece for the American Association of Medical Colleges that two huge reasons for pain treatment disparities are that, quote, people process pain differently, unquote, meaning, like, they outwardly show different symptoms when they're experiencing pain. And additionally, quote, assessment of pain is inherently subjective. Additionally, in cases of medical ambiguity, as when pain isn't caused by an obvious physical condition such as traumatic injury, providers rely more heavily on their own judgment, which can be influenced by personal perceptions and biases, unquote. Implicit bias in pain treatment can be life-changing, traumatic, and deadly. Pain treatment is already an uphill battle. Chronic pain treatment is exponentially harder. When your pain is not believed by the people supposedly treating you, it is dangerous, and when the hospitals in which these professionals work prevent you from having equitable access to resources, such as patient advocates and diagnostics, it is dehumanizing and incredibly harmful. In this time of COVID, right now, we are also seeing a huge disparity in Black people in America finding treatment for symptoms of coronavirus, as racism in healthcare is amplified by decreased resources in segregated neighborhoods and the incredible and often insurmountable cost of healthcare in America. Despite how bleak all of this seems, there is hope. And there are things you, yes, you, listening right now can do, even if you're not in healthcare.
first and foremost is believe Black people when they tell you they're in pain, especially Black women. Second, support universal healthcare and vote for people who support it. Healthcare is a human right, and we're not free until the last freaking GoFundMe for a Black person's medical bills isn't needed anymore. I think that's it for now. If you have any thoughts about what we should discuss next episode, let me know by reaching out on Instagram at @lowercasesober and just send me a DM. I'm going to be posting a few articles in the description of this episode.
Thanks for listening. My name's Izzy D'Esposito. I record, edit, and produce this podcast. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find the podcast on Instagram at @lowercasesober. If you want to support the podcast, again, you can visit patreon.com/lowercasesober. Resources, as always, are in the description. If you or a loved one is struggling with alcohol dependence, sending lots of love.
And a huge shout out and thank you to our Patreon patrons, Allie, Sarah, Taylor, Allie, and Mo. Thank you so, so much for your support. If you want to join these folks and have a shout out at the end of every single Lowercase Sober episode, you can do so by going to patreon.com/lowercasesober and choosing the tier that works for you and joining us as a patron. But also just thank you for listening and thank you for your support so far. I really like making this podcast and it's people like you who make it possible. So thank you. I'll see you next time.